My name is David Kessler. The book I've written is Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. My website is grief.com. I also have a website, sixthstage.com, for people if they want to order the book and get a free companion class.
Oh, okay. David, Finding Meaning was for me a fresh look at grieving and a comforting one, even though I was a basket case this weekend reading it. It was very emotional. Why now was the right time for this book?
Well, I was privileged to work with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in adapting her stages from dying to grief. And there have been so many misunderstandings and misuse over the years. Elizabeth would have never intended the stages to be a map for grief or for us to do them linear or in any sort of way that's very strict. They were very organic. And while they're not a map, most people recognize the feelings that were in the stages. But when we looked at acceptance, there was an that like, oh, I found acceptance. And the reality is, grief doesn't end. You know, for me, it's more about in time, hopefully, we'll remember the person with more love than pain. So there was all those thoughts out there about the stages. And I'd often thought there was another stage, perhaps the stage of meaning. And I had pondered it, written about it, thought about it. And then a few years ago, my younger son died. And it was, even as a grief expert, it turned my world upside down. And I felt like there had to be more than acceptance. I didn't want his life and his death to happen and end with just accepting it. I wanted to find meaning for his life and for his death. And I sort of looked around at how we grieve these days. And I think we're a generation that our parents are getting older, siblings, friends, so many losses are occurring. And I think we want more, we want meaning. So that's really what brought me to them.
I've underlined so many really fantastic lines in your book, including one that said that in grief, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. I love that.
Well, I tell people as I do lectures and retreats and work with people that there's no taking away the pain of a loved one dying. That's just going to be the reality of life. But suffering is what our crazy mind does. And so many people relate to it that after grief, after a loss, we would think our mind would be kind to us and go, oh my goodness, you've had a horrible loss. I'm going to be very compassionate with you. But our mind doesn't do that. Our mind blames us or blames someone else. And certainly there are times that there's a true responsible action that needs to be taken because something was done wrong. But most of the time, we want death to have a reason, and we find blame, and we have a mind that comments and makes negative comments and is just, you know, tells us that our loved one died because we didn't call them that day, or because maybe we had an argument or we had a complicated relationship with them, and ends up blaming us instead of being compassionate towards us. And I always talk about my goal is to help people find the pure grief, not all the noise that our mind makes.
I also like the buffalo going through the storm. They go out to meet the storm. That for me was meaningful because I think of drugs as not something, at least for me, that I wanted to do to soften any of the pain of grief for me. I just wanted to go through it like a buffalo.
That was fascinating for me to realize that one of our instincts is to avoid the grief, to run from the grief, to not deal with the grief. Mm-hmm. And then I learned in this, you know, incredible documentary about how when there's a storm coming, the buffaloes understand that if they run from the storm, they're in it longer. But if they run towards it, the painful piece of it is much shorter. So I thought that's fascinating, the idea that rather than avoiding the grief, which makes all the, you know, hideous parts of it even longer, what if we, like the buffalo, understood that this grief is part of the love we have for our loved one who died. And we went towards it instead of avoided it.
Makes a lot of sense to me. Would you tell me about your Joe Biden connection?
Sure. I was driving one day and on my phone, a call came in and I answered it on the speakerphone in the car. And I heard this voice saying, you know, hi, I have a call from the vice president. And I was a bit shocked and immediately pulled over to take the call. And he had called and had said he had been reading some of my work and just wanted to talk about it. And it had really resonated with him. And he was dealing with the loss of his own son. And what was fascinating is that we talked to what it's like to be in the public eye in dealing with grief and having your son die. And at the same time, the more we talked and he asked me how I got into this work, we found that the very thing that had gotten me into this work, which was my mother dying in 1973, while there was one of the first mass shootings going on in the U.S., was when he was beginning his career. And part of his first week of work was dealing with the shooting that was in my childhood. So we had that connection that began, as well as obviously, you know, he's dealt with grief between his own wife and child dying decades ago in the 70s, and then now again when his own son had died. So I'm, you know, I was obviously honored to get that call and to talk to him about that. And I also was really taken by how he had been so open in his grieving, which I think whenever men are open in their grieving and setting examples, that's a very important thing.
What about the one-year myth that people talk about?
Well, there is this myth in our society that I wanted to bust in this new book, this idea that after a year, you're done. Like, it's been a year. Mm-hmm. We're all done. Widow weeds off, you know, it's all finished. And most people in grief don't identify with that. They feel like the grief goes on, but there is this sense of, why are you still grieving now? And people will often ask me, you know, how long is someone going to grieve? And I'll often say, well, how long is the person going to be dead? Because if they're going to be dead for a long time, you're going to grieve for a long time. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't mean we'll always grieve with pain. We'll eventually grieve with love, but we'll miss that person.
Having said that, did you find that, I found that the second year was almost harder in some ways than the first, I guess because of the finality of it in my head.
Right, and it's interesting that that's what we found, and there have been some studies. There's one study I think about that asked people in grief, which year was the first? Which year was the worst for you? Mm. Was it the first year, the second year, or both years? And it came back one-third as the responses that some people felt like the first year was the worst, some people felt like the second year was the worst, and one-third felt like both were the worst. But the reality is people find the first year, you're in shock, you're in the busyness of things. It's a time when your mind's just trying to grapple with, has this really happened? The second year, people will often say, is when they realize they're truly never coming back. And then when you begin to hit all the anniversaries and they're not here, that's certainly, you know, all the holidays and everything, people really have a challenging time with that second year.
You talked about Christmas and Hanukkah after your son died. And I think you seem to hit the right note, not forcing your other son to put up ornaments or anything like that. It was just get through it in many ways.
Right. And in my family, we do Hanukkah and Christmas, so we do both. And that first Christmas, it was just, what do we do here? How do I, as you know, the father handled Christmas, and I thought I need to do a little, but no more than anyone wants. And as you read in the book, that turns out with just putting lights on the tree. That's like all I could do was just get the tree up, get the lights out. We lit the Hanukkah candles, and there was one point my son just sort of sat on the couch and just, you know, couldn't do anything. And I had to realize that's what grief looks like. For him, just showing up and sitting was the most he could do. And we have to sort of let everyone be where they are when it comes to grief.
And that's for Thanksgiving is coming up not too long from now. And certainly that has its own feelings as you gather around the table.
Absolutely. And we have to think about, you know, how we're going to handle that. And certainly there's ways that we can acknowledge that loss. I think the worst thing that people find is if they pretend it didn't happen and it's just another Thanksgiving. And the reality is it's not. And, you know, people will become triggered by little things like hearing, isn't it great we're all together for Thanksgiving? And, you know, someone at the table will go, no, we're not all here.
Yeah.
Someone's missing this year. So, you know, there's so many things. And I put out lots of videos around that time on my social media about how to help with those holidays, because they're very, very challenging for people in grief.
At grief.com?
Grief.com, I'll have them, and also on all my social media pages. And usually I put up something at holidaygrief.com is another site they can go to that I usually have a video there about the holidays.
You talk about what you believe makes it a little easier to deal with our deceased loved ones' possessions.
Right. A couple of things that I've realized from decades of working with people in grief, as well as my own loss, is that, first of all, we want to keep everything. And people don't understand the psychology of why it's so difficult to deal with this, is because each one of those possessions feels like evidence that our loved one was here and that they lived. And we're kind of being asked by everyone in society to decrease the evidence that our loved one was there and here, and who wants to do that? So one, on a practical level, people often have to do this, some letting go of some things. And I always tell people, you can take a picture of everything. And the reality is, if you have a picture of it, you will have the same exact emotional response as if you kept the possession. So in other words, I don't have to have a picture of my father in his favorite suit. If I have a picture of my father in his favorite suit, that will give me the same exact response of actually keeping his suit. Mm. I don't have to have my son's car to remember it. Just a picture will be enough. But the bigger thing I tell people about possessions is when they're not wanting to let go of the evidence their loved one was here, I tell them the thing we don't often realize is we are the biggest piece of evidence that they were here. We're the living, breathing evidence that they lived, they died, and their life mattered and changes things forever.
A few thoughts on what not to say if we're on the other side of things and offering condolences. And maybe things that might be just right to say.
No one teaches us the things to say and the things to not say.
Why is that, I wonder? Is that?
I just think we'd sort of like to avoid it.
Avoid it, period, yeah.
Avoid it, and we don't know how to. You know, in a strange way, I'm teaching people what our great-grandparents knew how to do, is to be with people who were in grief and be with people who were dying. So some of those things that we want to avoid are saying, I know what it's like for you. I know what you're feeling. I can't imagine what you're going through. Or pointing out the silver lining. Isn't it good they died quickly? Or isn't it better they're not struggling anymore? And we sort of try to do the silver lining. And the reality is, the most comforting things are the ones that aren't active. The ones that are like, I don't know what to say, but just know I'm here for you. I don't know what your pain is like, but I'm walking this path with you. I'm going to be here by your side. Yeah. And also, we have a society that just always wants to say to people in grief, tell me what you need. They don't know what they need. They're in grief.
Yeah.
Why don't we just do things for them? Why don't we just bring a meal by? Why don't we, you know, and one of the things is we all know how to ramp up in the first week, but what do we do in the third week, the fourth week, the third month? You know, how do we keep showing up for them? And that's important, that we keep showing up, not just that first week. One of the things so many people tell me is how, you know, at the funeral, they just hear, we're all here for you. And then a week later, everyone is gone.
You can't find them.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this was such a tremendous book, and it could have been a really good book. But because of your personal tragedy threaded through the book, it made it a great book in my reading.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's such a strange thing. You know, as I was writing this book, and you can feel me in the book as I'm sort of giving the advice for grief and dealing with how to get through loss. As you said, you can feel my own struggles coming up. And there's this overwhelming sense I went through of my younger son is not supposed to be in my book. Mm. My son's not supposed to die. And that's a feeling that people in grief can relate to, that my husband's not supposed to die. My brother's not supposed to die. My child's not supposed to die. You know, we have this road we all picture we're going to go through and be happily ever after into the sunset. And then death occurs and just, you know, rocks and destroys our world. So a lot of the feelings that people hear me struggling with, they realize are the feelings they have for all their losses also. And, yes. You know, thank you for that compliment on the book. And I think that people appreciate that I'm not a grief specialist in the academic world who's telling them what all the latest studies say, but
yes,
I'm also coming from a place of this is my world too, and we're all in this together.
David, did you ever feel, or maybe you feel this a lot, that it may be time to set down your burden? Do you ever consider getting into another line of work? Because this must be very wonderful for you, but draining.
Well, I'll tell you, as I began this work and was in my 20s and 30s and 40s and sort of felt myself becoming the grief guy, I was like, oh, I don't know that this is what I want to be. So I certainly had times in my life that I thought, is this it? Is this what I'm doing? But I'll tell you, And even after my own son died, I thought, am I ever going to do this work again? But helping is healing.
Yeah.
And there's, for some reason, because of my own childhood, because of the shooting I grew up with, the mother dying, this is where my strength lies, that I want to help others in this area. You know, I look at other people, my goodness, I have friends who deal with child abuse, and I'm like, oh, I don't know how you could do that. And they're like, I don't know how you could do that. But I think in our own areas, we have certain gifts that sustain us. And I find it such a privilege to be able to go into the, you know, people's worst moments of their lives. And I can't take those moments away, but I can make them just a little bit easier.
I feel that. I definitely feel that. Anything else you want to add? Your Finding Meaning seminars. How can we find out more about them?
You can go to grief.com and look under events. I have many, many seminars. I'm going to be going to 30 cities and 3 countries. So I'll be all through the U.S. and professionals go, people in grief go. There's one-day workshops, there's weekends. I also have online classes. I just want to make sure that anyone who wants help can find it out there.
Well, thank you so much for writing the book, first of all, and taking the time to talk to me this morning. You were great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.